Hello everyone and welcome to Raya Affairs. My name is Nicola and I'll be your host for this episode. Raya is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Raya is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind the scenes of decision makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Raya Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As always, we start with a disclaimer that expressed opinion in this episode are welcome, even though they are not a direct reflection of Raya, as we specialize in unbiased writing. So in today's episode, we will be talking about why the UK plan to return the Chagos Islands to Mauritius has been put on hold, and what that means for Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Joining me today is Ángel Rodríguez Moreno, who recently wrote an article on the topic. So hello, Ángel, and thank you very much for joining me today. I know you have already been on the podcast with us, but I will still ask you to introduce yourself to our audience.
Of course, Nico. Okay, so, well, thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure to do these kind of interviews with you. I'll introduce myself then. I studied international relations and business administration, a dual degree at a university, and then I started to work in circular economy and trade, more or less. But I did specialize in climate security and environmental peace building, how all these climate factors and international relations interact in the global sphere. But yes, that's a short introduction.
Great. Thank you very much, Ángel. And as always, you already know, before we start, I'll ask you to answer again our usual icebreaking question. This time you get to choose another leader. So could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world would you want to have a conversation with and why?
Okay, so last time I chose Lee Kuan Yew from Singapore. Now I'm going to choose a very controversial one. I'm going to choose Modi in India, and I think it really aligns with what we're going to talk today. Why I'm going to choose Modi? Because he's definitely changing India. I'm going to say if it's in a good way or a bad way, I'm not going to go there. But he's putting India on the map. And I really want to know his vision of India in the next 20 years.
Wow, yeah, that's very interesting. It's an interesting pick. Thank you very much, Ángel. And now I would say that we can start our conversation about your article. So on October 3rd, 2024, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer's cabinet announced its decision to transfer the Chagos Archipelago to the Mauritius, effectively ending the British Indian Ocean territory nearly 60 years after its creation. So could you please just give us just a brief overview of the recent history of this chain of islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean?
Of course. So I'm going to try to explain it from the perspective of Chagosians, who were the ones who once lived in this archipelago. But unfortunately, it's true that the archipelago has been kind of like shifted and adapted to the different colonial presence in the Indian Ocean, from the Portuguese to the French to the British. So I'll go first for the French. So the French established coconut plantations on the island. And in fact, if you go now today, these plantations don't exist anymore, but you can even find some letters and signs about them. Then, because the French were there, they also brought some enslaved Africans from Madagascar, Mozambique, in the late 18th century. And this created some sort of like a Creole community. And in fact, the language that they speak there, it's some sort of a mixture between Asian languages with African languages, with also a French sort of spicy in it. But then, unfortunately, in 1814, under the Treaty of Paris, France ceded Mauritius and its independencies, among them the Chagos Archipelago, to the United Kingdom. And the UK decided to separate the Chagos from Mauritius from the BOT, so the British Indian Ocean Territory. And they, after that, decided to create Diego Garcia. Well, Diego Garcia is the island. I mean, the military base in Diego Garcia, along with the US. And to do that, they expelled all Chagosians living in this archipelago, approximately 2,000 people. They were resettled in Mauritius primarily, but then some of them in Seychelles. But I must say that this is key to understand the life of Chagossians, since after their forced displacement, they have been living hard conditions in these new locations.
Well, thank you very much for this brief historical introduction to our episode. And now I would say that we can talk about the deal for the handover. So the announcement of the handover of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius was celebrated by international law advocates and human rights groups. So can you please walk us through what the Chagos handover deal actually entails and why it was significant for Starmer's foreign policy?
Sure. So let's go first for the what. So what the Chagos handover actually entails. So the negotiations started under Rishi Sunak, so the conservatives, not the Labour government. And this is important, okay? During this period, we don't really know what was under the table, but we do know that Rishi Sunak decided to pursue this agreement based on two hypotheses. First, the sovereignty transfer was gonna happen. We don't know when, but it was inevitable. And under this situation, he wanted to retain control over Diego García. How does he do that? The agreement specifically says that Chagos will then go back to under sovereignty of Mauritius, but Diego García, the actual military base that is co-hosted by the US and the UK, will be state-retained under British administration through a 99-year lease agreement with Mauritius, which includes financial compensation, as Mauritius will receive £90 million annually, adjusted for inflation, of course, to continue the operations in this military base. And then lastly, it also includes some resettlement provisions, but they are not really clarified. Remember, Chagossians were forcibly displaced, and so this needs to also be addressed. Then why was it significant for Starmer's foreign policy? I want to introduce you to a term, progressive realism. This term has existed for a while, but David Lammy, which is the foreign secretary in the UK, decided to coin this term in an article to more or less explain what this new era of Labour foreign policy was going to be. In a nutshell, it means that, we're going to still maintain this realism that the UK is well known for, maintaining military power, hard power, etc. But at the same time, they're going to try to pursue a support for international law, ethical diplomacy, etc., that it's very contrary to what the previous cabinet was doing, which was more focused on a conservative approach, realpolitik, and exceptionalism.
Well, thank you very much. And now I would like to talk about this kind of progressive realism more in detail. So Starmer campaigned on this idea of an alternative British foreign policy. And your article mentions his attempts to court Global South allies in the post-Brexit period. And the Chagos deal probably reflects this desire to pivot toward human rights and rule-based diplomacy. The UK, in fact, faced international legal pressure on this matter for years, and the legal rulings from both the ICJ and the Court of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea clearly sided with Mauritius. So do you think that the deal was kind of meant to symbolically repair the country's image?
Exactly. So this is a very good question. So within this idea, this scope of progressive realism, the agreement over Chagos is just an illustration, a test of the possible success of change in foreign policy of the UK government, right? So we also must remember that under this kind of legal situation, Keir Starmer, before being in the cabinet, he was a human rights lawyer and former director of public prosecution, right? So let's do kind of like a summary about the legal basis of this agreement, this concession. And let's remember why I'm saying that this agreement was inevitable, this transfer. So First, in 2000, the UK High Court ruling decided to rule that the removal of Chagossians in the 70s, 60s was unlawful. And then in 2008, the House of Lords decided to overturn the earlier ruling in a narrow 3-2 decision, blocking the Chagossians' right to return. So you see there's some disagreement. Then in 2010, the UK government created the Marine Protected Area, an MPA, around the Chagos Archipelago. But this was understood by Chagossians' human rights groups as a way to prevent their return and resettlement. Then, in 2015, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, in a case brought by Mauritius, ruled that the UK's establishment of the MPA indeed violated the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, and that Mauritius had not been properly consulted. Finally, as you say, in 2019, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, in a strongly worded advisory opinion, declared that the UK's continued administration of the Chagos Island is indeed unlawful, stating that the colonization of Mauritius was never lawfully completed. And finally, in 2021, the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea reinforced Mauritius' claim to sovereignty, kind of like supporting or confirming the ICJ's position and further pressuring the UK. That's why we mean that the decolonization of Chagos is inevitable and that there's a lot of pressure put in this agreement.
So as you said, the handover deal is seen kind of as inevitable. However, a few months after the deal was announced, the handover was already put on hold. A new prime minister in Mauritius, the return of Donald Trump to the White House, and renewed concerns over strategic control, migration, and China's expanding influence have put the agreement into question. So could you tell us what happened and why were these political changes so disruptive to the agreement?
Of course. So let's go back to October. So when the agreement was signed in October 2024. So at that time, we had a government in Mauritius that supported the agreement that was on the table during the negotiations since Rishi Sunak kind of like elaborating this agreement and this consensus. And this government in Mauritius was led by Jugnot, and he emphasized that the agreement would allow Mauritius to implement a resettlement program for displaced Chagossians, excluding Diego Garcia. Remember, we are excluding that island, or sorry, atoll, and that the UK would provide financial support for this initiative. So it was indeed a win-win. At that time as well, we had in the US Joe Biden. Joe Biden was serving as the president, and he welcomed the agreement. So he gave some significance in resolving long-standing historical challenges to diplomacy. And in fact, he even stated, "I applaud the historic agreement and conclusion of negotiations between the Republic of Mauritius and the UK on the status of the Chagos Archipelago." However, everything changed just 1 month later. So in November 2024, Mauritius held general elections. But there was a last-minute scandal involving leaked recordings of government officials, and the government's response, being a temporary social media blackout, didn't meet the public expectations. And eventually, due to this widespread dissatisfaction, it led to the defeat of the government, and the new government led by Navi Ramgoolam secured the seats for the National Assembly, and eventually, just after gaining power, decided to reassess Chagos Agreement. On the other hand, in January 2025, we all know that Donald Trump decided to express skepticism regarding the UK-Mauritius Agreement, because they said that they put that the UK and Mauritius would put US control over Diego Garcia at risk, that would mean a security concern. And specifically, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, expressed the potential implications for the strategic US military base on Diego Garcia in regards to how China was growing its influence in the region. Back a few years before the agreement, China already signed a free trade agreement with Mauritius, which for Marco Rubio and other even conservatives in the UK and other political figures meant that Mauritius were shifting towards east rather than west. But, Nico, I must say that we know how Trump can be very, a surprise every single week, and we cannot really know what's going to happen. That's why, for example, in February, then he changed dramatically his opinion on the article, and he said that, well, he literally said specifically, I think we'll be inclined to go along with your country. However, this was a very elegant move by Keir Starmer. Why? Because in that meeting, he decided to agree with Donald Trump on a series of elements, showing more his realist side of this progressive realism kind of doctrine. For example, increasing his budget for the military and defense, but also he even gave to Donald Trump a letter from the king of the United Kingdom, which for him was a nice gift, right? So we also understand that interpersonal relations also play a nice role. However, we do not know what's going to happen next, since first, as I said, we cannot really know what's going to be the next step for Donald Trump. And the new government of Mauritius still expresses skepticism and wants to push a little bit farther the UK when it comes to this new agreement.
So we don't know what's going to happen, of course, but it seems like the military base on Diego Garcia is the central issue here. So my next question regards exactly this. So Diego Garcia is the largest atoll in the archipelago, and it was transformed into a strategic asset co-managed by the US and the UK, as you mentioned before. And to protect the military base established there, people were forcibly relocated to Mauritius and the Seychelles. So could you please tell us more about the strategic importance of Diego Garcia? Why is it such a critical military asset for the UK and the US? So in other words, what makes this tiny island so geopolitically important?
That's a great question. So let's imagine the Indian Ocean. So the Indian Ocean has Africa to the west, it has India and South Asia to the north, and it has Southeast Asia and Australia to the east, right? Well, Diego Garcia is exactly in the middle of the Indian Ocean. On the one hand, these military base is important because it allows the US and the UK to oversee the monitoring and control of maritime flows across the Indian Ocean. And this includes fossil fuels from the Persian Gulf to Europe and the Pacific Rim. For example, let's remember that key shipping lanes used by over 40% of the world's all shipments go around this area and are part of the US Indo-Pacific Command's strategic posture. And then on the other hand, we also have critical minerals and technological components flowing from East Africa and East Asia, right, to Europe and other parts of the world. On the other hand, we also have to understand the importance of the Garcia as a military base when it comes to deployment of forces or power in other regions, or even humanitarian deployments to strategically volatile regions, such as the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and the Horn of Africa. As an example, in 2001, so the Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was really important that the Garcia was under US and UK control. It allowed to deploy military forces rapidly. And when it comes to humanitarian deployments, we can, for example, give the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. So with the US and UK forces staging humanitarian missions, it enabled a rapid response that helped them strengthen diplomatic relations with the affected nations and populations. And lastly, during the Cold War, for example, the Oathia housed nuclear powered submarines armed with cruise missiles. And in fact, it is still equipped with advanced naval and aerial weaponry designed for strategic deterrence and rapid deployment.
So, in your article, you also mentioned that there's a migration crisis happening on the island. There have been several reports about dozens of refugees detained for months in terrible conditions, and concerns about irregular migration, asylum seekers, and the limited infrastructure on Diego Garcia probably played a role as well in the development of this situation. So maybe the handover wasn't just symbolic. It was also a move to manage security and migration risks. So how do you think these humanitarian issues are impacting the political narrative? And what implications does the UK's handling of asylum seekers in Diego Garcia have for its international human rights reputation? Especially considering that, as you said, Starmer is trying to develop this new kind of approach to foreign policy, and it's his own background as a human rights lawyer probably affects this.
Exactly, and in fact, it's such a dilemma, right? Since the 70s, the ATO was a strategic asset for security, and now, after the arrival of 60 Sri Lankan Tamil asylum seekers between 2021 and 2024, we saw that this strategic asset became a strategic concern. So what happened? So we have dozens of Sri Lankan migrants that arrived to Diego Garcia after their boat encountered difficulties in route to Canada, where they actually wanted to go. They were held in what have been described as hellish conditions, and including rat-infested, leaking tents with reported sexual assaults, hunger strikes, and numerous incidents of self-harm. These put a lot of pressure to the BOT. And in December 2024, the BOT Supreme Court ruled that these individuals were unlawfully detained for over 3 years. We had the press going to this secretive island and reporting these events. We also had human rights groups reporting the hardship of these asylum seekers. And eventually, the UK's handling of this situation has drawn criticism from these organizations, legal experts, which put this kind of take of Keir Starmer on as a human rights lawyer at stake. But then, a little bit later, there was some articles that started to spark in the UK stating that by the arrival of these migrants to Diego Garcia and by the decided rule that some of them would go to the UK to kind of like address this situation, this could create a backdoor of migrants to enter into the United Kingdom. We must remember that migration is a key topic and even political cleavage for Britain. And these kind of concerns allow for the far right, for example, to express kind of like criticism over the situation and reaffirm that some sort of solution in the long term has to be put in place. That's why there is some kind of pressure on FEST, rapidly giving sovereignty of Chagos to Mauritius, and then on the other hand, addressing the situation of these asylum seekers and the resettling of Chagosians to the archipelago.
Wow, so not only security concerns regarding military deployment, but as you said, there's also the question of the migrants and asylum seekers trying to enter the UK through this kind of backdoor channel. But right now I want to go back to the security concerns, particularly in relation with Chinese influence on the islands. China signed a free trade agreement with Mauritius in 2021. And I would like to ask you, how has the Trump administration responded to this, especially given Republican fears around security at Diego Garcia and expanding Chinese influence in the region? And how do you think Starmer plans to reconcile the UK security commitments with Mauritius' growing ties to China?
That's a great question. So first, as I said, so in 2021, China and Mauritius signed a free trade agreement. And that's why Marco Rubio voiced concerns about China's so-called Maling influence in the region and emphasized that the Chagos Agreement would actually mean a huge security concern for the US and the operations in Diego Garcia. As I said, other figures such as Kemi Badenoch, leader of the Conservative Party, criticizing the agreement on under the same kind of like argument that Chinese influence in the Indian Ocean means that this agreement is not supposed to take place, or of course, Nigel Farage, the leader of the Reform UK, saying that the agreement was a betrayal of national interests. So why are these people saying this? So China has state-owned enterprises that have invested in at least 70 ports throughout the Indian Ocean region through the Belt and Road Initiative. I'm just going to mention two that are more or less next to Chagos. So first we have Gwadar, so in Pakistan, and also the Hambanot Tota port in Sri Lanka, which is a lease of 99 years after Sri Lanka struggled to repay Chinese loans, raising concerns about like potential military use, just as specifically as the US and the UK are doing with Diego Garcia since the 70s. So under this kind of situation, of course, this concern, we can understand it. But Starmer's foreign policy, let's remember, it's a shift. And in fact, he wants to be more close to China and Xi Jinping. In November 2024, Starmer became the first UK Prime Minister in 6 years to meet with Xi Jinping during the G20 summit in Rio de Janeiro. He emphasized the importance of a consistent, durable and respectful relationship between the two nations, focusing on collaborations in areas such as trade, climate change, and global security. And Starmer acknowledged the need for open discussions on contentious issues, including human rights and China's stance on the Ukraine conflict. So we see that Starmer, on the one hand, wants to balance China by, for example, maintaining their control over Diego Garcia, and aligning with Donald Trump, trying to get his approval on this agreement. But on the other hand, they want also to strengthen relations with China in order to maintain a kind of an autonomy and find new allies after Brexit, after various years of the UK losing some sort of their presence in the global sphere.
Wow, thank you very much for your answer, Angel. It was super clear, and it seems clear to me that looking at the Indian Ocean more broadly, there are many geopolitical risks associated with the UK losing strategic control of Diego Garcia. And China might use this diplomatic instability to kind of expand its influence in Mauritius or in the broader region. But right now, I would like to bring in another important regional player, India. Because historically, New Delhi always opposed the militarization of the Indian Ocean, but now it seems to welcome a Western presence. So what are the reasons behind this shift?
Exactly. So I began this interview saying that I wanted to talk with Modi, right? So let's talk about Modi. So New Delhi, as you say, has historically opposed to the securitization of the Indian Ocean, viewing foreign military bases, particularly Diego Garcia, as vestiges of colonial influence and a threat to regional autonomy. This opposition was formally expressed through India's leading role in the 1971 UN Declaration on the Indian Ocean as the Zone of Peace, which called for the removal of any foreign military presence and in the region, and the preservation of the ocean as a demilitarized space. Also, we must remember that at that time, during the Cold War, India decided to be part of this non-aligned movement, and they promoted this philosophy, hence rejected the Soviet Union's presence in the region, but also the UK and the US. However, since Modi came in, they wanted to put India on the map, and they started to promote this kind of Indianization, right, of India, thinking of India, the international sphere as Bharat, not India, kind of promoting the BJP, the party's philosophy, at a domestic level, but also an international level. And under this kind of rise of India in the global sphere, and specifically under the emergence of the global multipolar system, they saw China, a historical enemy, as a rival, right? We must remember that it's true that under the last few months, we saw a shift and the relations between China and India improving. But in the 50s, they already had a war, the Sino-Indian War. They had a lot of conflicts when it comes to the border, since the rise of the Chinese Communist Party in China. And we have seen a lot of kind of balancing of the Belt and Road Initiative from China by pursuing other kind of policies, such as what now they call in India the String of Pearls, which is kind of like kind of promoting again the same idea of building ports, infrastructure across the world, but kind of putting India on the map rather than China. We can see the corridor that is being proposed to connect the Middle East, India, and Europe, or for example, this kind of support to Diego García. However, again, Modi wants to reaffirm his position, and he doesn't want to see an archipelago still controlled by the UK and the US. In fact, they support Mauritius in here, and in March of 2025, so just now, he reaffirmed this position, stating that in the context of Chagos, we fully respect the sovereignty of Mauritius. However, as I said, they still want to see the UK and the US retaining this kind of control over Diego García, just in case some support is needed to counterbalance China under this volatile multipolar system.
So my last question is about Starmer himself. Where does all this leave him? And do you think he'll push the deal forward even without support from Washington? Or is this another case of a foreign policy ambition meeting geopolitical reality?
That's the question, right? So as I said, I believe that the Chagos handover is going to be the test of this new approach that Starmer wants to pursue, this progressive realism. Why? Because on the one hand, they have to appeal to Donald Trump, which is not easy to do. We saw Donald Trump engaging in a trade war with China already, escalating so quickly. We also saw Washington rejecting the European Union completely, stating that even the European Union was meant to create havoc to the US. And under this situation, Starmer needs to appeal to him and ensure that these historical relations between both nations are still maintained and even strengthened. The meeting that they had in February 2025, where, as I said, so Starmer gave a letter from the king just to gain this interpersonal relation with Donald Trump, is a move to get his kind of like friendship with him, right? But at the same time, we must understand that stammer has an ideology and an approach completely different from Donald Trump. He wants to pursue ethical diplomacy. He wants to enforce public international law, respecting the ICJ's advisory opinion, respecting human rights groups' pressure to promote the resettlement of Chagosians to Chagos. He wants to address the security concerns that some people are stating regarding the arrival of migrants to Diego Garcia and how the UK didn't properly treated or protected these communities of migrants in the atoll, right? So yes, in that light, Starmer's idealistic foreign policy goals are running up against hard power concerns such as national security, alliance cohesion, and post-Brexit geopolitical leverage. But even if he personally wants to push the agreement forward, he needs to slow walk or even renegotiate parts of the deal. I'm sure he'll do that. I'm sure he's gonna get the deal executed. But we just don't know when, and we just don't know what's gonna be given in exchange to Mauritius and to the US.
Yeah, so this seems like the final test for Starmer's progressive realism. And this has been great. I would say that with this, we can end today's episode. And thank you very much, Ankel, for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Nico. It's always a pleasure to be here with you. So call me next time, and I hope that our listeners enjoy the interview.
Definitely, definitely. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. And for sure, we will have you with your next article. Can't wait to record a new episode with you. And this has been a super interesting discussion. And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out Ankel's article at rayagroup.org and to follow us on social media to receive updates on new articles and contents. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.